first time Bruce M. Beeler came across a wattled smoky honey eater, a new species of bird he discovered in a remote Papua New Guinea rainforest several years ago, he ignored it. That's because it looks so much like its cousin, the common smoky honey eater. In his latest book, Lost Worlds, Mr. Beeler explains that the common smoky honey eater was so common it had become a nuisance. He says, in fact, it was the first bird that would appear in your binoculars every time you were looking for something rare and desirable. His book is published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Bruce Beeler to the show today. Hello.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Can you describe what it felt like to identify a new species? Is this something that happens only very rarely?
Well, if you're working on birds, it happens rarely. The birds have really been well worked over globally because they're feathery and attractive, just like the butterflies and the orchids and the rhododendrons, very popular with the British back in the colonial Victorian era. Some of the other groups, like the frogs, some of the plant groups, many of the insect groups, are still very, very poorly known. So as I'm a bird man, of course, I wanted to discover a new bird.
So there aren't too many that remain unidentified and unnamed.
That's correct. Most of them, in fact, would be in Amazonia and the Andes. So South America is essentially the bird continent.
Although you discovered your bird when you were with a group of people in New Guinea, people who were likely to discover new things, authorities on frogs, butterflies, plants.
That's right.
Small mammals.
And we discovered more than, on this one single trip, in 2 weeks up on top of this mountain, we discovered more than 40 species new to science, which is pretty remarkable.
So you didn't mention Papua New Guinea. I would assume that it is one of the places where you're most likely to discover new
things. It is. There are three great wildernesses still on Earth, or three great tropical wildernesses, I should say. One is the island of New Guinea, which is the largest tropical island. One is the Congo Basin in Africa, and of course, the last and most important is the mighty Amazon.
And I've heard that you received a flood of emails from the public when your discovery was announced. Were you surprised and how excited the general public becomes about findings like that?
Field biologists tend to labor in obscurity. We do our job. We love being in nature, and we love telling our story, but we tend to tell our story to each other. And it's pretty rare that we get to spend time with people like yourself on the radio or on TV. So it was a surprise to us.
You discovered the species in an area in western New Guinea that's extremely difficult to reach. How did you get there?
Well, you know, I first stated my intention to go there in 1978 or 1979.
The remotest part of the world, you say?
It's in some ways is. It took me some 27 years to get there. So there are political impediments to going, and there are physical impediments to going, and then there are infrastructural impediments to going. So difficult to get a visa to do research in western New Guinea.
And why is that? Because they want to protect the area?
No. Some areas are, around the world are treated as sensitive. Think of yourself as an Indonesian scientist wanting to do work in some state in the U.S. There'd be many, many political impediments to doing this kind of exploration work in the United States, mainly because national governments tend to be quite bureaucratic. This particular area, western New Guinea, had suffered from a separatist movement for about 10 or 12 years. And that was the main reason. So there was actual political instability, and the military really didn't want foreigners of any stripe in there snooping around.
But you concluded that you and your colleagues were likely the first people to ever have visited this rainforest. It's called the Foja?
I say Foya Mountains.
Foya.
Yeah. Other people say Foja.
No signs that humans had ever been in the area?
Not exactly. In fact, our colleague Jared Diamond, of Guns, Germs, and Steel fame, went there in 1979. So he went there and did a bird survey. And he just did some very quick bird surveys, which actually rediscovered a very important lost bower bird. He found out and proved that was from this mountain range, the Foyas. But there hadn't been any comprehensive biological surveys there. So we're splitting hairs a little bit. He went there in 1979, we didn't get back there till 2005. So you can see how isolated it is.
What about the local people? Why haven't they wandered in there?
Well, it's strange because in New Guinea, there are dozens and dozens of mountain people. These are forest people that live in the mountains. who climb over the highest peaks. These, they go up even as high as the glaciers. This is 14, 15,000 feet. And yet in this little mountain range, the people that live around it are lowland people. They like the hot, steamy jungle. They aren't mountain people, and they don't deign to go up into this mountain for some reason. And they do. One of the reasons they say is that their spirit place is in the summits of these mountains, and they don't really want to go up and meet those spirits face on.
But still, you had two local men, Isaac and Timothy, who acted as guides and shared information about all these
yes.
rare birds
That's
and animals
right.
that you were looking for.
That's true.
So how did they know so much about them if they were staying in the lowlands?
The oral tradition. Clearly, at times, their people, the Papasena and the Cuerba people, their relatives, their grandfathers or great-grandfathers or aunts and uncles had gone up into these mountains for reasons that they know and we don't. So why they don't go up there anymore, I don't know. In some cases, for instance, during the war, when they started seeing dogfights between American and Japanese fighter planes, many of the people in these villages, they abandoned their villages and went and hid in the forest. They went up into the hills and hid. It could have been at those times that they went up and discovered these things.
But you write that you have in the past mistakenly believed that the locals weren't as interested as you were as an outsider in the whole matter of these rainforests and conserving these rainforests.
Well, it's complicated because, of course, Timothy and Isaac, and they're the leaders of these two tribes. They live in the rainforest. They think of the rainforest as their whole environment, and they can't imagine it not being there. And it's their patrimony. So they can't imagine it being endangered, frankly, because they haven't actually seen the loggers or oil palm developers. They haven't gotten to them yet. So they can't really imagine it, I think.
Well, you're right that just 7% of the Earth's surface is covered by rainforest. How much land was rainforest 100 years ago?
I think probably, I don't know that number, but on the order of, it was probably twice to three times as much. It is the last of those natural environments that's really been heavily hit because it's one of the most difficult to develop. So really, in the last 25 years, we've seen most of the destruction.
Aren't local people often reluctant to set aside an area of the forest to be protected or conserved?
Well, one of the questions, do you have conservation with people or without? And working at Conservation International, all our work, we start from the grassroots up. So your conversation starts at the community. And the concept is that the local communities, the local forest people, will be the stewards of those forests. So you never aspire as conservationists to translocate those stewards away from the forest. You want the people nearest the forest to be the ones having that voice and actually actively conserving, because they're there. It's their backyard. If something bad starts to happen, they're the ones that will see it. Often you get governments that are distant. You have a government park office that's 200 or 300 miles away from the park. They don't even have the money to visit the park and check it. It's the local communities in the forest who are the ones who can actually protect that forest.
So what happens when outsiders, even fellow countrymen, come in there and tell them what would be best when they have their own ideas?
Well, it's a conversation. It can be complicated. And even us, you know, Conservation International, it's a Washington-based organization. We don't go in and tell them what to do. What we try to do is provide options, give them ideas, tell them what's happening in other places. In some cases, take leaders to places where they can see oil palm firsthand or see large-scale industrial logging firsthand, so they can get an idea of what the impact of these sorts of large-scale development could be.
My guest is Bruce M. Beeler, whose latest book is Lost Worlds, Adventures in the Tropical Rainforest, published by Yale University Press. You've made trips to Madagascar, Indonesia, the Philippines, Panama, the Ivory Coast, other areas in Papua New Guinea. Did you find that the indigenous people were pretty much of a similar mind when it came to the way they related to their land?
I think that, you know, one of the sad discoveries of this sort of work around the world and the tropics is, in many cases, the indigenous people have moved, or they have been encouraged to be moved, or they physically have been forced off their lands, or are gone. So in places like New Guinea, that's one of the few places where the indigenous people are not only in the forest, but they're actually running the governments. So in many places, I would say the indigenous groups are more a threat than the wildlife that we're conserving. So mm-hmm. we need to conserve these indigenous communities, their language, their culture, as well as the wildlife and the forest. It's a package.
As we've seen in the Amazon, where only recently the Brazilian government and the Venezuelan government have realized that perhaps it's in their best interest to help these indigenous people instead of eradicate them. There have been genocidal periods or force them out of their lands or force them into the cities.
So I think we are moving in the right direction, and governments are. In Brazil, there is a whole network of indigenous reserves. So these aren't parks. These are indigenous reserves. These are big tracts of forest that have rich populations of wildlife and have indigenous people living in them and managing these areas for their long-term well-being. So it's a great idea.
Let's go back to the Foya rainforest.
Okay.
You say it's hard to appreciate visiting a place free of cats, black rats, minor birds, starlings, and house sparrows, let alone strip malls, paved roads, and sport utility vehicles. Do you know of any other untouched places waiting to be discovered?
Well, I'm sure there are there. There are a few places in Western New Guinea that I would, you know, tell you to go to, maybe the Kumama Mountains or the Fakfak Mountains farther west. These are, again, small mountain ranges that are off the beaten track, not in sort of the main routes that people travel. Certainly there would be some in the corners of the Andes and probably in the Congo as well. They aren't well known. That's why they haven't been visited, because, you know, people like myself, naturalists, explorers, biologists, pore over maps. We now have Google Earth. We can zoom in on a place and see it from the air. It's hard for these little corners of the world to hide.
Well, in the past, anthropologists were concerned that they might affect a culture by bringing in Western ideas. Were you concerned that your visit to the forest might set unforeseen changes in motion, kind of the butterfly effect?
That's a good question, and people are concerned about that. What the simple fact is that the reason we went and did this survey was because we had started a project that was dedicated to conserving this larger ecosystem that includes the Foya Mountains. It's the largest unroded tract of tropical rainforest in the whole Asia-Pacific region. It's called the Mambaramu Basin. It's about 8 million hectares. That's about 12 million acres, with not a single road crossing it. This is one of the jewels in the crown of the Asia-Pacific natural world. We think it's a little bit like a small version of the Amazon, important for the climate, important for climate change, one of Indonesia's jewels. The fact is that our mandate is to the globe, to sort of global well-being. The local people are part of the conversation, and they will be part of the decision-making. But in some cases, the importance of these resources transcend these local communities. Now, in fairness, the local communities want development too. They want to see change too. They feel isolated. They have no road. They can't, you know, take a Jeep and get to the city. They have to hitch a ride on a motor canoe and then cross a rapids and then get on a tugboat, you know, a little putt-putt boat that takes you to the capital. Most of the communities, if you talk to them, what do they need most? Access to medicine, hospitals, better education. A lot of that comes with transportation. So most of the communities, even though they're pro-conservation, are also pro-development.
And some technologies would actually make their lives easier.
Absolutely.
Even just the introduction of the steel axe at one point.
Absolutely. It was a huge change. In this case, what they're probably asking for is solar. Solar electricity, so they can have some lighting at night, so they can have a refrigerator to store medicines, vaccines, antivenins, things like that. All those things are important to their well-being.
You tell a funny story about your first foray into the jungle of Papua New Guinea when you were a 23-year-old student accompanied by a couple of pigeon-speaking local guides.
That's right.
Titi and Timis, they would eat everything that was killed, and you were trying to save them for your research. How do you get past that sort of thing?
Well, I think there's a negotiation. You know, they're your hosts and guides, and you have to bend a little bit.
And they killed every snake they saw. Why? Even the harmless ones?
Well, most of the people who live today on the island of New Guinea are barefoot. They have They've probably worn shoes or flip-flops, in at times. In the conditions they live in the village, they wear out very quickly. They don't have access to regular access to Walmart or Target. So a barefoot person in the forest is at risk. You step on one of these poisonous snakes, you die. You can't get to the hospital soon enough, essentially. So it's a simple equation. They kill every snake. It reduces the chances that they or their children will die of snake bite. I've seen a number of people die of snake bite in places I've worked in Papua New Guinea, and it's a very sad part of their environment.
There's been talk recently about how nature and ecotourism could allow local people to earn money and help protect the environment. We've seen that sort of thing in Costa Rica, but now they're talking about it in places like Madagascar. You've said it usually doesn't work out that way. Why not?
Well, it is complicated because one of the main difficulties is equitable sharing of benefits, and this is mainly cash. The resource is either informally or formally belonging to the local communities. These may be indigenous communities. But it's hard for indigenous communities to establish the kind of tourist services that are wanted by the international traveler. So what instead happens is middlemen or middle people come in, either from a foreign country or from the capital, will come in and set up the whole infrastructure. They'll build a lodge. They'll create all the transportation. So what happens is most of the benefits goes back to the capital and doesn't really go, unless it's handled very carefully, doesn't go to the community. So you have to be very cautious about that.
But at the same time, I'd imagine that the cultural divide between the indigenous people and the tourists would be so wide that you'd need middlemen.
Probably. What is hard for the local groups is to anticipate what food the local people, the visitors want, and how they want their lodging, and what they, that's the cultural divide. So you do need someone to tell what works and what doesn't work.
You say that you honeymooned with your wife Carol along the Sea River in the Lac-a-Kemou Basin in Papua New Guinea in 1982. And Carol's grandmother gave you only half your wedding gift, $500.
Wasn't because she wonderful?
She said she was going to give you the other $500 if you returned from the jungle still married.
Isn't that great?
Does
she
that
has
put
such
a lot
a
of
sense of humor.
Did that put a lot of pressure on the
Not
marriage?
Not really. It was wonderful. You never forget something like that. She, bless her soul, had a sense of humor and a practical nature too, because there was a core of practicality there. She was very generous, and yet she knew that life is full of quirks and uncertainties, and especially a honeymoon in New Guinea is not most people's idea of an ideal honeymoon.
Bruce M. Beeler's latest book, Beehler, the book Lost Worlds: Adventures in the Tropical Rainforest, published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.